For the week of June 16th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 195, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Metropolis, I'm Michael Giltz.
And Metropolis being Manhattan, right?
It's the home of Superman.
Okay. Well, not anymore, because it's been destroyed.
Clearly, yes.
Yes. If you saw the movie Man of Steel, because heaven forbid they actually named the film Superman, since there have been, what, how many relaunches of Superman in the past two decades?
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the movie. I'm waiting for real aliens to show up and be like, well, we studied your films and your television and your books, and this is clearly where you meant us to show up. So here we are in New York.
Yes, exactly.
It's clearly where we're meant to come.
But, you know, when those aliens come, will they be on Twitter like we are? Because you can follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our username. And we're also on Facebook. If you look up Showbiz Sandbox, you'll find our page that you can like. So look us up, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Or maybe the aliens will email us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com, aliens. Okay, don't get it wrong, because if you mistype it, we won't get the email.
And
if you
aliens try, is offensive. Maybe you should call them undocumented visitors.
Well, undocumented visitors from another planet or solar system. You can also call us if you have phones in your galaxy. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. But yes, the news this past weekend was all about Superman and Man of Steel.
Absolutely.
And did you see the film?
Yes, I did. I saw it on Sunday at noon. The first 2D screening of the day in Times Square. I said, I showed up at 11:55 a.m. I said, how many tickets are left? You know, how full is the theater? He said, there are 236 seats available.
Wow. Okay.
That's just the capacity that we have now. I didn't have to buy it in advance. I didn't have to whatever. I just showed up. I bought a ticket for the time I wanted because, you know, they've got 4,000 screens and how many ever show times. That's just the way the world is now. You don't have to plan as much in advance because they're ready for you.
Well, I've just been chomping at the bit here for you to finish speaking so that I could say you saw Man of Steel and I offer my condolences.
It wasn't painfully bad. It wasn't good. I was indifferent to it, but, you know.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that people are indifferent to a lot of, not only the movies, but what is taking place in them, specifically all this carnage. And on today's show, we'll be speaking with Kyle Buchanan. He's the movies editor at New York Magazine. He wrote an interesting feature last week asking whether it was possible for Hollywood to make a blockbuster without evoking the tragic events of September 11th, specifically in some of this summer's apocalyptic imagery in movies like Man of Steel, as we just mentioned, Star Trek Into Darkness, and soon World War Z. Now, speaking of blockbusters, some of the filmmakers who helped launch modern-day tentpole franchise releases are now all doom and gloom, at least for the industry. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas are predicting an implosion for Hollywood, and that is a quote, an implosion for Hollywood, among many other prognostications they made during a joint appearance last week at USC, the University of Southern California, or as we like to call it here in Southern California, the University of Spoiled Children. We'll fill you in on what they had to say. You know, Apple last week, while we were recording, they finally announced their streaming music service. And frankly, I'm still not all that impressed. And hey, if you're an intern, you're supposed to be impressed merely at the opportunity to hang out at some of the entertainment industry's biggest companies. Now a judge says, you're also supposed to be paid, apparently. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Man of Steel. It grossed $200 million worldwide. That includes early screenings on Thursday, midnight screenings Thursday night, into Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That's in North America where they had those special screenings. And then, of course, around the world, $200 million to start. It made $128 million domestically and another $72 million in some key markets overseas where it's doing very, very well. Got a lot more to say about this movie, so let's get through the rest of the list, and then we'll come back to The Man of Steel. At number two around the world, Fast and Furious 6, another $29 million. It's at $637 million worldwide. I looked it up, and you know what? That's chump change these days. You don't even get into the top 50 all time when you make $630 million worldwide. And number three is After Earth, the Will Smith sci-fi film. It's doing just as poorly overseas as it did domestically. It made $28 million. It's at $145 million and counting. At number four is Now You See Me, which is the illusionist turned con artist movie. That has started to open up overseas where it's doing solid business. It made $26 million worldwide. It's at $107 million and counting. At number five, Star Trek Into Darkness, which is now the biggest Star Trek film of all time, not accounting for inflation yet, but it's getting there. Another $23 million. It's at $412 million and counting. And $200 million of that is overseas, where that's finally broken into the sort of blockbuster consciousness of the rest of the world. It was always a big film in North America.
For some reason, I would have expected this film to make like $600-700 million. I don't know why.
Well, it should have, because the first relaunch was so successful, and usually that establishes a film. And then the second one, if it's good, will capitalize on that. And it's making more money than Star Trek, but it isn't nearly as good a film. And it's sort of, you know, it's making just about the same domestically, and it's introducing it worldwide, but it's not capitalizing the way a really good film might have done. So, you know, it's you can't call it a commercial disappointment, because it's going to be the highest grossing of all time, and the budget is not exponentially higher, but it seems a lost opportunity. Certainly, you know, it puts the pressure on him. He's launching Star Wars. He just did a Star Trek movie that didn't do great. Now he's relaunching Star Wars. You know, what's he going to do? The heat is on. The magic and the glow of him has passed.
And you're talking about J.J. Abrams, the director.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
He was the golden boy. He gets to do Star Trek and Star Wars. And now we're a little worried about the fact that he gets to do Star Trek and Star Wars.
You're saying he might be the silver...
He took four years to do this movie, and he didn't get the script even close to write.
Okay. And so you're saying he might be the silver or bronze boy instead of the golden boy.
That's right.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with bronze. If you get to the Olympics, you want to get a bronze. Silver is the one that sucks. If you get a bronze, you say, ah, I meddled. If you get a gold, you're like, I won. If you get a silver, you're like, son of a bitch. That's what my mother always says. And though she doesn't say that curse word. At number six around the world is This Is the End, the apocalyptic comedy. Just like Superman, it basically made back its budget in the first weekend. However, unlike Superman, that budget was $32 million. Now, that movie opened up on Tuesday night. So this is just the era of release dates. It's crazy. Some open Thursday at 7, some open Tuesday at 10, others open, you know, midnight. It's just, it's a hodgepodge of release dates. It's really hard to compare films now. But essentially, it opened in North America Tuesday night. It's made $32 million so far. That's what the budget was. And it got very good reviews.
Yeah, it's
so
got far, like 87%, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes.
I had no interest in seeing it, but thanks to the reviews, I'm intrigued. I may head out to the theater to check it out. And number seven, the reviews kept me away from The Hangover 3, but it made another $20 million, and it's at $310 million worldwide. It tripled its budget. And number eight, the animated family film Epic, it made another $14 million, but it's slowing down. It made $214 million worldwide. And number nine and 10, two movies that grossed $12 million. One is a flop. One is essentially a success, depending on how big its budget is. The Internship is the Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson comedy. It's made $36 million, and it's an embarrassment. At number 10 is The Great Gatsby, which made another $12 million, and it passed the $300 million mark worldwide. It's the highest grossing Baz Luhrmann film of all time, and it's a good success, especially if you believe them when they say the budget is $105 million. And if the budget is $105 million, that certainly doesn't count all the money they're handing over to Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. At number 11 is The Purge, the horror film, which is falling hard like these horror thriller films always do. But it's made $60 million worldwide. It made another $10 million this weekend. And number 12, that South Korean comic drama we talked about, which is tearing up the box office in that country, setting records left and right. It made another $8 million, and it's at $30 million and counting. And at the bottom, Iron Man 3, which is finally about to fall off the charts completely. It's at $1.2 billion worldwide. But of course, the big news was Man of Steel, which was a big meh as far as critics were concerned. But audiences seem to like it a lot more.
Well, it was the biggest June opening ever at $113 million, at least from midnight on, because, of course, those midnight screenings don't count. It beat out Toy Story 3, which made $110 million. But I got to tell you, you know, I've seen it in 2D. I've seen it in 3D. I didn't like it either time.
Now, those Thursday night openings, by the way, they seem standard now. I don't know. Is that just New York and L.A., or do they do that all over the country? Because basically, any big movie that opens, you can go see it midnight on Thursday. Is that standard around the country? Because we get reports on the Thursday midnight box office for virtually every film.
It is standard operating procedure now, at least in North America.
What isn't standard operating procedure are these Walmart screenings. This was a crazy twist on a movie's opening. If you went to Walmart and you pre-ordered a DVD combo pack or whatever of Man of Steel for when it came out on DVD 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months from now, if you pre-ordered it, you got a free ticket to see the movie Thursday at 7 p.m.
I would be very interested to know how that did.
Well, they say it grossed $12 million. Now, I don't know how they figured that out, the $12 million. Is that $12 million that Walmart paid in ticket sales for people who bought the DVD? Is it $12 million in DVD sales that they got a free ticket to the screening? And of course, most people don't want to see it alone. So I'm not sure what that $12 million is. Is that the $12 million that people spent on a Blu-ray combo pack for which they got a free ticket? Or I don't know what's going on. And of course, if you bought a combo pack, you got a single ticket, but you couldn't bring your wife. So you only got to go with friends who also bought the combo pack. I'm not sure how it worked. It's bizarre, but they got to see it before anyone else. And frankly, I'd rather see it Thursday at 7 than Thursday at midnight.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It's kind of tempting. Yeah, so I'm not sure how it happened. You're gambling a little bit, but of course, a ticket could be $20 if you're seeing it in 3D IMAX. So it's an extra, what, $5 or $10 to get a DVD and a free ticket to the movie? You know, it's that extra $5 and you get the DVD combo pack. It's kind of what I've been arguing about books. You buy the ebook, and then if you want to upgrade, hey, well, why not? So in this case, you know you're going to buy a movie ticket. For an extra $5, you're guaranteed to get a DVD combo pack, and you get to see the movie before anyone else. Is it worth it? Maybe.
Yeah, I can tell you with Man of Steel, it wasn't worth it.
We've learned that already, Sperling. But now, was the 3D worth it? Here's an interesting thing. I haven't heard one person talk about the 3D. And I suddenly thought, you know what? 6 months ago, every review talked about the 3D of a movie. Was it good? Was it bad? Was it well done? Is it worth it? Should you go see it that way? And I went back and looked. I read like a dozen reviews. Not one of them mentioned the 3D or IMAX. Not one of them. Hollywood Reporter, Variety, New York Times, The Washington Post, The LA Times, Fanboy Reviews. I went on Ain't It Cool News, and I could not find a reference to 3D. Is that a good thing because it's just like color and people accept it as normal way of things? Or is it a bad thing because Hollywood wants you to pay extra to see it in 3D and nobody cares about it anymore?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it's the latter. I think people just don't care about it anymore and they just assume that, you know what, it's like reviewing first class versus economy. Most people are going to be in economy and go see it in economy. And in the case of Man of Steel, that's exactly what happened. We don't have exact figures, but we're thinking what? Somewhere around 30% of tickets were sold for 3D, which is exactly what the industry thought was going to happen.
What? No bull hockey. What do you mean that's what they thought was going to happen?
Actually, I know this because,
you mean for the tracking for this movie? 6 months ago, a year ago, they thought every movie would be 3D and 60, 70, 80% of ticket sales would be 3D because that's what they were getting.
Well, when we talked to John Fithian on episode 132 back in January of 2012, he said that we're predicting that effectively it's going to be much like, and I'm stealing his words when I say coach and first class, because that's what he said most people don't fly first class, and that's what these big giant IMAX 3D spectacles will wind up becoming, is a minority of people will see them, they'll have the choice to see them that way, and most people will go see them in 2D.
Please, how much did they spend to convert this movie to 3D?
I have no idea.
30 million?
No, probably 15.
For 3D and IMAX?
The IMAX, I don't know, but for 3D, it was probably 15.
15? That seems awfully low for a 2-hour and 23-minute movie.
No,
you're saying
that's
$15 million. It's now down to 15. Well, that's what they grossed in their premium pricing. They made it an extra $15 million. So they broke even on opening weekend. I guess everything after that is gravy, except as we know, the fanboys are the ones who come out. But I'm sorry, they had 60% of the screenings of the showtimes in New York City were for premium pricing in New York City on opening weekend. Saturday and Sunday, I went through the screens, looked at Manhattan, added up every showtime available for 2D and every showtime available for 3D IMAX, which was almost non-existent, and 3D IMAX, which was the most. Added them up, and 60% of the showtimes were for premium pricing, and only 40% of the showtimes were for 2D. But guess what? 70% of the tickets sold were for that 40% of showtimes. Everybody was crammed into those showtimes for the 40%, and the 3D, they must have been half empty.
I have
no
idea.
Don't tell me that that's what they intended.
I do know one thing. You have way too much time on your hands.
Don't tell me that Hollywood only wants to sell. This has fallen for 6 months now. It's not going to stop at 30%. It's going to go down to 20%. This is Superman. If there was a movie, fanboys should have been thrilled to dish out extra money to see a movie in 3D. It's Superman. It's Man of Steel. And they're down to 30%. And that's this week. in 3 months, 6 months from now, it's going to be 20%, 15%. Don't tell me it's not going to keep dropping, because every person I know hates 3D.
Soon they're going to take one of the Ds out of 2D. It's just going to be 1D.
That would be great. I think it's a disaster. I think it's the death of 3D. It was a stunt. It was malarkey. They want us to pay. And you know how the LA Times, talk about being a shill for the industry. They said, well, so it looks like, where was their quote? About 41% of moviegoers were willing to shell out a few extra bucks to see the picture in 3D. A few extra bucks? If you saw it in 3D IMAX in New York, it was 50% more expensive. 50%. Wow. It was $7 versus, you know, at $7 extra. It was $14.50 to see it in 2D and $21.50 to see it in 3D IMAX. It was an extra $4 or almost 30% to see it in just 3D. That's a lot of money. That's a huge price difference. And they're saying, oh, a few extra bucks. 50% extra is not a few extra bucks. It's outrageous. People hate it. It's been a horrible trend. All the best screenings are set aside for the biggest theater for 3D and IMAX, and people aren't going. Don't tell me it's not a disaster.
Well, it's funny, Michael, that you should mention that word disaster, because I'd like to add somebody to this conversation about Man of Steel, because as I walked out of the theater, all I could think about is there were how many fight sequences in that film? How many big, giant set pieces where, frankly, I think we saw two or three Manhattans just obliterated. And Kyle Buchanan, he's the movies editor, as I mentioned earlier, over at New York Magazine, he wrote a very interesting piece called Is It Possible to Make a Hollywood Blockbuster Without Evoking 9/11? Kyle, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I get out of the film, and of course, the people I'm seeing with, we're all talking about the fact that one big giant special effect after another are just buildings falling to the ground, and not once does Superman ever kind of say, wait a second, there's tens of thousands of people in those buildings. You know, instead, he's worried about Lois Lane. I mean, and then I read your piece and I think, this is exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of fans of the character who come at it from the perspective of Superman should have more concern for the citizens of Metropolis because they are surely perishing by the thousands as these buildings fall. But then again, you can look at it from a macro perspective. This summer has just been full of these kinds of set pieces. You know, San Francisco was destroyed in Star Trek Into Darkness, and in World War Z, which comes out this week, plenty more metropolitan cities are destroyed. And it's just this orgy of buildings falling, and you have to wonder why we're getting so much of it right now.
Well, now, to be clear as well, of course, Hollywood has always blown things up. But your point is that they are specifically evoking 9/11 in the way the scenes are shot, how they're presented, the characters, they're covered in dust. It's not just, you know, it's a big spectacle, but it's literally evoking that tragedy in particular.
Definitely. Don't get me wrong. You know, obviously, back since the heyday of Godzilla and through Independence Day, we've had movies like this. But I think there are a couple reasons for why it seems to have become so extreme as of late. You know, it used to be that we'd get these action movies that that like laid waste to vast quantities of cities in sort of small doses. I think right now we're just hitting some sort of flashpoint where the ante always has to be upped from last summer's, you know, big spectacular. And so now we have all these stake-setting moments where, you know, giant cities are completely demolished. And the odd thing about it is I think it actually does the opposite of what it's intended to do. When you see these buildings fall and when you see these cities destroyed, it doesn't pull you further into the story. It sort of pushes you out of it. You know, you don't know who's passing away in there. It seems like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people might be dying in these films. And yet our heroes seem relatively unfazed. So it's sort of a black mark against the heroes, but also the filmmakers, because they're giving us something that we can't quite connect with. You know, I say in the piece that, when millions die in a movie, it's almost sort of such a mind-boggling number that it becomes meaningless, you know, and definitely in the Man of Steel scene, we have 20 minutes of building battering, and it culminates in a scene where specific characters might get killed, and that's by far the more galvanizing moment. The other stuff is just sort of off-putting.
Right, you call it an orgy of gratuitous building battering. And you write, instead of trying to top the mayhem in Man of Steel next year, instead of continuing to mine one of the worst days in American history for a series of wowzer trailer moments, can we give the pummeled buildings a break and find creative new obstacles for our heroes to overcome. I could not agree more. When I was reading your piece, I just thought, how is it that he's reading my mind?
Yeah, and you know what? I don't want to even seem like a humorless scold about this. I think that creatively, it would be better for us to just step away from this sort of thing. There are so many buildings that fall and just so many, when you have these scenes that are pitting these two invulnerable characters against each other and they're throwing themselves through buildings, there's really no stakes. They're not setting up the stakes of the victims who are dying in these buildings, and they're not setting up many stakes of the fight because, these characters can't die, essentially, or at least they're not getting really wounded. So it's just 20 minutes of détente. It's incredibly violent détente, but a fight scene where there aren't any stakes and it doesn't seem to be escalating. I guess they think that it's escalating in the sense that buildings are falling, but I would prefer to see some escalation, between the two characters.
Well, you sparked a lot of comments online, and we'll get to the dumb comments because you can't have comments without people being idiots. But you did spark some smart comments as well. One person talked about how, of course, after World War II, we got noir, and during the Depression, we had gangster films. And in the post 9/11 era, we have this sort of spectacle of city after city and, mass tragedy occurring. And one line a number of people singled out that you wrote, which I liked a lot as well, was that you said, quote, "Action heroes used to prevent disasters, but now they can only avenge them." And that's clearly where we are creatively as far as this brief period after 9/11.
Yeah, it's an interesting and sort of sad, bittersweet note. If you look back at the old Superman movies, he would be preventing Zod from destroying any buildings. Now, at this point, Zod destroys so many that Superman is left with no recourse but to, do something sort of violent and final. It's interesting because I think that a lot of times movies can be used for catharsis. So when we have these movies where all these buildings are falling and the heroes have to avenge something that's already taken place, and I think you'll feel that a lot more in World War Z even, because World War Z just feels hopeless. It feels like so much has happened and we're so screwed, and it evokes this feeling of post 9/11 despair to go along with all those cities being destroyed. You just have to think, okay, so are we effectively channeling whatever we're going through these things? Because there's also the sort of awkward sense that these moments are being used as, big spectacle wow moments for the trailer, which feels sort of tacky,
Well, I guess the question is society, reflected in the movies, or are the movies going to affect society? Will these movies kind of numb us to this kind of disaster so that when a 9/11 happens, unless two or three or four or five buildings fall down, unless it looks like Transformers 4, or whatever the name of that movie was, where half of Chicago was destroyed, unless it looks like that, well, it wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just odd how all that iconography from 9/11 has just been absorbed so quickly into the action movie bloodstream. I think sort of an awkward analogy, and we'll see if it works if I say it out loud. When people go back and watch Citizen Kane, you've never seen it before. So many of the things that seem so exceptional and startling about that movie have just been co-opted by any movie maker, so it doesn't seem necessarily as novel as it did at one point. And I wonder if the iconography from 9/11 has been so fully absorbed by action movie directors that when people, who didn't live through 9/11 go back and look at it, is it just going to seem of a piece with these $200 million temples? Or is it going to seem like a real terrible day in American history?
Well, you had a lot of comments, and some people said, the more contrary people said, buildings fall in other countries too. So, it's not just America. So get over yourself thinking that because a building falls, it's about 9/11. That was sort of the gist of the naysayers.
I think you'll find that there are some people who are extremely defensive of Superman and Christopher Nolan in particular. And so they'll come out and they'll, they'll defend their territory there. But it's fair to say, this has been happening in movies for a long time. It's just that it's become so specific and so unique. I mean, you can't argue with the fact that everybody is covered in ash. It's one of those details that we didn't have before 9/11. People would come out without a scratch or, they'd have a little attractive scrape on their forehead, but all these buildings could fall and it just wouldn't have those specific details of how the girders were bent or how covered in white ash everybody would be. And it just seems sort of perverse that the big lessons that action movie makers have learned since 9/11 are just technical ones.
Well, I mean, if I recall correctly, there was a movie called The Island by Michael Bay, where Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson fell like 90 stories off of a building and somehow managed to survive and looked just as stunning as when they, you know, started falling.
Well, you know, Sterling, we could do a whole other show about that trope when people jump 90 feet in a movie and survive. We've had a lot of that this summer, too. But that's a whole other discussion entirely.
And then they kiss because they survived. It's like the We're Alive, well, Let's Kiss moment.
They also kiss in Man of Steel after Metropolis has been completely destroyed. I don't know if that would be paramount on anybody's mind. I mean, Henry Cavill's an attractive guy, but time and place, everybody. Time and place.
I'll tell you what offended me, and that was Star Trek Into Darkness. And it also had moments that evoked 9/11 and things that seemed gratuitous. I mean, we had this big terrorist attack at the beginning of the movie, and then later in the movie, we have more mayhem on Earth. And I thought, really? Isn't that enough? But what I really disliked was at the end of the film, as the credits began, they had a scroll dedicated to the military or first response. I'm like, no. You don't get to evoke 9/11 and praise the military in your stupid, dumb popcorn movie. I found that really going too far.
Yeah, and you know, it's that line you quoted before about how heroes used to prevent these disasters and now they can only avenge them. In previous Star Trek movies, we would, you know, or Star Trek episodes, it would often come down to, oh, the Earth is in peril, and at the last minute, you know, whatever threat is advancing, approaching the planet, will be prevented. In Star Trek Into Darkness, that just doesn't happen. In fact, in the two rebooted Star Trek movies, they don't have a good track record for preventing these disasters at all. You know, an entire planet was destroyed in the first one, and San Francisco was wiped out in the second. And it's just sort of like, you know, I know they want big stakes, but it feels so, it doesn't feel like it feels so disassociated from what we're seeing on screen. Because it's essentially just clearing the deck and clearing a path for a foot race and a chase scene. You know, nobody's really reacting to anything that's happened. But it's far more devastating than any of the things that have happened in the entire movie thus far.
I think that, frankly, it's CGI, this visual effects. It's so much easier now thanks to computers and these visual effects artists. And what is ironic, and we talk about it quite a bit here on Showbiz Sandbox, is that more and more these effects are being relied on for these big, giant tentpole movies and for these apocalyptic images that were shown. And yet the studios themselves are squeezing these visual effects companies out of existence. So, as you know, they want more CGI, and yet they're unwilling to pay for it.
Yeah, and you know what? A lot of the time what you end up with is these movies like World War Z, where some of the effects are extremely compelling, especially because they're collecting the 9/11 iconography. And then just like you described, suddenly there's a cut rate effect shot that was probably done by a different special effects house. You know, I think there's just so much that we could get by pulling back a little. And I'll give you an example. Inception. Inception is a movie where buildings do fall, but it's in a completely different context. And there are beautiful, stunning images in that movie that are very trailer ready, that don't rely on CG or city destruction. And they really entice people to go see it.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because as I was walking out of this, and maybe it's because Christopher Nolan is credited with the story of Man of Steel, as I'm walking out of the film for the first time, I thought to myself, you know, when Christopher Nolan blows something up, he blows something up. He goes and he finds a building for Batman, or what was it, The Dark Knight, and he blew that building up. I mean, it was a building that was going to be blown up anyway, but, you know, it was going to be kind of rebuilt. And so he blew a building up in real life. When he needs a truck to flip over, he doesn't rely on CGI. He spends six months flipping a real truck over, and he has one shot at doing it. And by actually having that physical presence, it makes it that much more effective.
Yeah, and I have a twofold response to that. One is that I think that when you are creating these shots in CG, the audience instinctively knows, oh, well, a camera couldn't be there without there being some sort of danger. And so they know that the shot was created in a computer, and they immediately are distanced from it. The audience just knows, okay, that can't be real, and that takes them out of the film. The second is that Christopher Nolan really made Gotham City a character in all three of those movies. And so by the third movie, where the whole city is under siege, it really feels significant and meaningful. Like, you can feel like the anguish and the anxiety and the fear that must be pervasive in that entire city. The thing with Man of Steel is that we get so little time in Metropolis that it doesn't register. It registers in just sort of like a base spectacle kind of way. But what do we know about this city aside from what you might be bringing to it from other versions of the Superman story? Like, hardly any, because we're really not getting much time there.
Yeah, and I guess because, let's face it, you say these characters can't be killed. I mean, that's very true, and I think that was part of Nolan's reason for bringing back a character or a villain like Zod rather than a villain like Lex Luthor for Superman, because if Superman can't be killed, then he can do anything. And Lex Luthor, it's just a matter of time before, I don't know, you know, he offs the villain. And I think the same is true here with Zod even. It's just a matter, you know, effectively that based on the premise and the structure and the way movies are structured, that Superman will survive. And the same is true of any of these films. It's not like the Starship Enterprise is going to go down and blow up and that's going to be it. Franchise over. So,
yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that Star Trek Into Darkness does have a main character die, but it's just handled in a way where you know it's about to be reversed. And I wonder if the filmmakers are essentially looking for somebody else that can kill, you know, by offering all these nameless thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, because they can't kill any of the main characters. They have to come up with some other way that death is looming and real as a threat. But I just don't think it's as effective as they seem to think it is.
I would agree, and I really have to thank you for your piece. It was a very well-written piece and summed up exactly what I was thinking and what I know the people I saw Man of Steel were thinking, and I appreciate you taking the time to come and speak with us about it. Again, it's Kyle Buchanan from New York Magazine, and where can people find your work? I guess at nymag.com, but you're also on Twitter.
Yes, I am minimally on Twitter. You can find me. My handle is Kyle Buchanan, that's B-U-C-H-A-N-A-N, but yeah, check out my work at New York Magazine and Vulture.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was good of Kyle to stop by. I worked at New York Magazine for a year, but anyway, I wanted to ask him, and I forgot to mention this, when I saw the movie on Sunday, I don't know about you, when I saw it on Sunday, they flashed the DC logo for DC Comics, not a sound. And I immediately thought about when Marvel came up for Spider-Man and Avengers, people were roaring and cheering and applauding just the logo for Marvel Comics. And I thought, ouch, that's got to hurt. Did you notice that?
Well, I saw one at a screening, the 3D version. And then the 2D version I did see in a theater, but it was not at a very crowded theater. And nobody, I had to at one point tell somebody, hey, can you pipe down back there?
How was the 3D? Was it any good? Was it well done?
Some of it was. The irony is that a lot of times the best part of the 3D are the production company logos.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, would you recommend people see it in 3D? Is it worth it?
No.
Well, I thought about that. The Marvel gets applause. And you know what else gets LucasArts or Lucasfilms? When you see Lucasfilms, it's like a new Star Wars movie or something. They're so rare, that makes you applaud as well, doesn't it?
I remember in 1997 when the...
Phantom Menace?
No, 97 was the re-release. They kind of re-released all of these, the original trilogy of Star Wars.
Not the original. It was they changed the end stuff and Han Solo fired first. But anyway.
That's true. Yeah, so they... refurbished and altered Star Wars and released those films, and the Lucasfilm logo showed up there, and sure enough, everybody was applauding the second that they saw it.
Absolutely.
And the same is true in the trailers. When they started the trailers for Phantom Menace, that Lucasfilm logo would flash and everybody would applaud.
Before anything happened, exactly. I suppose Spielberg and Lucas still get applause even today.
Well, I think even they're saying that they're having trouble making their movies because they're not making movies that cost $400 million or, okay, I'm exaggerating here, but I think Superman cost $190 million to make. And, this is our way of getting into talking about how Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were at USC. They were at the opening of a new media arts building, and they had some pretty dire predictions for Hollywood in general.
That's right. And of course, major Hollywood stars and directors often weigh in on the business side. But of course, you know, some of them are pretty savvy about business. Spielberg and Lucas both have made a lot of money, but they're often better at the artistic end of movies than the business end. A few years ago, George Lucas weighed in on the movie business, and he bizarrely insisted that Hollywood needed to stop making big budget blockbusters, you know, those movies he made his fortune on, and just back lots of tiny $2 million movies. This despite the fact his entire career was built around big budget Hollywood films. Now Spielberg is predicting doom and gloom for Hollywood, and George Lucas agrees with him. Let's look at what they said and see if we agree. This is all per a Hollywood Reporter story covering Spielberg and Lucas speaking at the opening of the USC School of Cinematic Arts. The big first thing Spielberg said was there's going to be, quote unquote, an implosion in the film industry. And he says it's inevitable because he predicts like a half dozen or so massive big budget movies are going to completely flop at the box office and change the industry forever.
Well, I'd go back to the 1960s and say, gee, you had, okay, Sound of Music and a lot of these...
Massive hit.
A lot of these big films, I mean, you know, Hollywood was in the same type of phase where they were just trying to give the audiences what they thought they wanted. But in the end, what they really wanted was they wanted Martin Scorsese, Francis Coppola. They wanted these darker, more personal films. Well, basically, in the 1960s was considered a low ebb of filmmaking, Hollywood filmmaking, because the studio system was over. There was like a 10-year span where, you know, finally with Bonnie and Clyde and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you had this kind of filmmaker auteur-driven cinema coming out of Hollywood. Finally,
But that's people want good movies.
Yes,
sometimes they want to see a big budget musical like The Sound of Music, and sometimes they want to see Taxi Driver, which was not a big hit at the box office. Sometimes they don't want to see Dr. Dolittle and Hello Dolly, which were two big flops, and they do want to see a small. But no, audiences are not in the mood for small dark films, nor are they in the mood for big massive heavy leaden blockbusters. They want to see good movies, and there's been lots of times in history where big movies have imploded, like Heaven's Gate. Toppled United Artists. Cleopatra was a disaster in the making, the most expensive movie of all time, perhaps even still if you adjust for inflation. So, I mean, John Carter was a big flop recently for Disney. So do you think that, you know, five or six movies could explode and completely flop? And if they did, how would that change the industry? What exactly would happen if that occurred?
Well, I think, Hollywood in general is it follows trends. So everybody... Yeah. Well, just, you know, I don't think it would necessarily alter the industry necessarily. It could topple a studio. Look at The Golden Compass. That movie tanked, right? And New Line Cinema is no longer. MGM had issues too with, I can't remember what film it was, but they made some disastrous movie and it just, you know, did the studio
in. But studios still make big blockbuster movies. They always have. They always will.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think they might make fewer of them for a short period of time, but it's all cyclical. So right now, $250 million blockbusters are all the rage. And Spielberg is right. Maybe a few of these films crash into the ground, and all of a sudden, the studios are saying, well, you know what, maybe we'll spend $75 million on some of these films, much smaller, and for a while, we'll just do smaller films.
So it's always happened, and so his prediction that it will change the industry forever is wrong.
Well, I think that I read that somebody
he's wrong.
Said, well, let me finish. I can't remember who said it, and I think it was on the AV Club that somebody said, well, these are some very good post addictions. They're not even predictions because they've already happened. They just happened in another era.
Well, here's the next thing he said. Spielberg said, what comes next or even before then will be price variances at movie theaters where, quote, you're going to have to pay $25 for the next Iron Man, but you're probably only going to have to pay $7 to see Lincoln, Spielberg.
To see Lincoln. You're breaking up a bit. I don't know what there's issue with our audio today. Hey, no problem. But yeah, he said $25 for, say, the Iron Man 9 and $7 for Lincoln 2, although I don't know necessarily what you'd see in Lincoln 2. He didn't say Lincoln 2, but, you know, he's saying movies like Lincoln will be $7. Well,
I'd love to pay $7 since I paid $14.50 to see Lincoln. But anyway, is he right or is he wrong?
Okay, to that, I don't think I'm going to answer that question. Hold on just a second. Let me have somebody that a good friend of ours, Mr. John Fithian. You might recall this moment from episode 132 in January of 2012.
And who is he?
I'm sorry, maybe I should have said that. John Fithian is the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, or NATO, the trade group that represents movie theater owners.
All right.
And I had asked him, you know, whether he thought variable pricing would ever come to pass, because it's something that's talked about quite frequently. And this is what he had to say.
I personally think that differentiated pricing model based on the movies would be a disaster in the long term, because you're essentially saying any low priced movie isn't any good. And you're betting, gambling that the high priced movie is good. And one thing we know is what we don't know in this business. And that is, until Friday night, when they start putting down their money at the box office and buying tickets, we really don't know what we've got. You know, we can do this sophisticated tracking, and we can make projections and assess the marketing spends, but we really don't know what we've got until we've got. And there are more surprises out there than there are predictable commercial results. And I would be very nervous that we'd take a movie that no one thinks is going to do a ton of business. You know, we'd take a Bridesmaids or a Help or, you know, any number of movies like that and say, oh, this is probably going to be a $30 million movie, so we'll just charge, you know, a lesser amount for it. And then it turns out to be, you know, one of the biggest movies of the season. So that's the danger of variable pricing.
In other words, exhibitors hate the idea of variable pricing. They always have. We've known that for years. How could Steven Spielberg not know that? And frankly, Mr. Spielberg, if you predict in advance what movies will have high ticket prices, then your low-budget personal passion project, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, would have had budget ticket pricing, whereas your big spectacle comedy starring John Belushi, 1941, would have had a premium pricing.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think ultimately part of the problem with variable pricing is the movies are something where you know how much you're going to pay when you go. You know, oh, it's going to cost between $10 and $15. If all of a sudden it was going to be $25, now I'm not saying this couldn't happen. I'm just saying it would really have to, it would shift the way films are marketed and the way movie theaters market themselves. And it's just a mindset shift would have to happen.
I just think it's bizarre that he's that out of touch with the industry. I think it's strange that he doesn't know how much that they would hate it, and how much there's a resistance to it, and how much it doesn't work for the model. But here's George Lucas. He agreed that massive changes are afoot, including film exhibition. And this is, he predicts that film exhibition is going to morph somewhat into a Broadway play model, whereby fewer movies are released, they stay in movie theaters for a year, and ticket prices are much higher.
Right. I mean, he's basically saying that movie going, you know, and again, I call this a post-diction or...
No, that's not...
I'm going to steal that from the AV Club. And
but
here's
it's not
why.
A post-diction.
All... And now, I'm not saying this is going to happen overnight, okay? I'm saying that, sure, that might happen, like, in 100 years, over the next 100 years. I mean, do we listen to the radio anymore? No. When was the last time you saw a vaudeville act?
Stop. George Opera? Lucas is predicting something that is the exact opposite of every trend in Hollywood for the past 30 years. For the past 30 years, movies have played in theaters shorter and shorter and shorter amounts of time. They open up around the world at the same time. They come out on video and DVD sooner and sooner. Windows are shrinking. And in fact, in small films, like the films he urges everyone to make, films that play at the IFC or other small theaters like Film Forum, those movies often come out on video on demand and streaming the same day or even before they open up in movie theaters. So everything, every conceivable trend in the industry, the entire business is geared towards shorter and shorter plays in theaters and coming out on video on demand and DVD and streaming sooner and sooner and sooner, if not even before they open up. So he's going the opposite of what every single trend has shown in the entire industry for 30 years.
Okay, so
don't talk about what might happen 50 or 1,000 years from now. The fact is, he's ignoring every possible element of the industry.
Okay, so you're taking it from that standpoint. I was actually just referring to the fact that movie going itself, the movie going experience may become more select, and people might. So I was talking about going to the theater. I agree with you that yes, the trend has been, you know, your movie's out. It's out on Thursday. Please remove it from the screen by Sunday because it's...
Right. I mean, and with piracy and video on demand, where they make as much money, if not more, at least at some points on TV, you know, and video on demand and streaming, the idea that movies would play in a theater for a year is so archaic and bizarre and out of touch with what the reality is, especially for all the tiny films he wants people to make. Those are out on video on demand and DVD before they even hit the theater. Well, that happens again and again. So again, he's just showing a complete cluelessness with the entire industry.
He said that the good stuff is going to be more like cable television, like on TiVo, like the internet. The, you know, all the streaming stuff would be internet television, And he said that, and I just thought, okay, you just said that cable television was like TiVo, and you called it internet television. If I were you, I'd stop talking now, lest somebody think you don't know what you're referring to, since you are George Lucas.
And then they also said, you got to be worried, because eventually they won't make Lincolns in the movie theaters, and they'll just go straight to TV, as mine almost was, Spielberg said. It was this close, ask HBO, this close to being a TV movie, to which I would say, and the problem is?
Well, here's the thing. Look at Behind the Candelabra, okay? This was the Steven Soderbergh film that was focused on and told the story.
I think it's an ideal TV movie.
Right, Liberace. Biopic. And it was a TV movie, and everybody loved it, and it was in Cannes, and everybody loved it. Steven Spielberg, on the other hand, is Steven Spielberg, and he gets what he wants, and so he was the person that actually made that film into a film that was in theaters, and so be it. It was a theatrical...
A substantial commercial hit.
Yes.
Whereas Behind the Candelabra, I think, fit better on television.
Yes.
But if Lincoln had been a miniseries for HBO, that would be fine. Spielberg produced Band of Brothers. Is that somehow an inferior work of art because it was on TV and not a movie? Is it would be a problem if Soderbergh made the rest of his films for HBO rather than theatrical release? I mean, some things you need a bigger budget and they're not as practical for television. I mean, but so what?
Well, I mean, like, I think I read somewhere that Tony Kushner's screenplay for Lincoln was like 400 pages long, and I'm exaggerating again. But
the first draft.
The first draft.
That's not an exaggeration at all.
And so, hey, you know what? It could have been a miniseries.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, so what? I mean, again, there's a cluelessness, like somehow being on TV is bad. You know, that's sort of that idiotic mindset, like, uh-oh, it might have just been a TV movie. Well, so what? If that's where your project fits best and you've got a backer, someone willing to let you make it, all the better. I just think their general attitude is so out of touch with the reality of the industry, how niche films are being made, how studios are marketing movies, how they're releasing them around the world, the windows that we face with, that they clearly do not listen to Showbiz Sandbox.
No, I think
that's clear.
I tried to, you know, I called Steven over the weekend and said, listen, you've really got to start listening. You know, you really got to start, downloading every week over at iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher. Hey, look, do it wherever podcasts are given away for free, because we don't cost anything. But you have to listen, because you'd be more informed and you wouldn't be saying some of these things. And, you know, I'll be honest, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, some of the things they're saying in total are, hey, the industry is going to change. But guess what? It always does. So it's not like, you know, it's saying like, hey, the sun's going to come up at some point down the road. Yeah, it probably will.
And of course, they've been right sometimes. Of course, they can't be wrong their entire career, but they're in grand old man stage where they're sort of making pronouncements about stuff they clearly don't know much about. 30 years ago, Lucas was saying digital, digital, digital. He was clearly right about that.
Well,
he was clearly right about the sound and picture quality in theaters needed to be better, and he launched TXX to make that happen, and that was an important step in the industry. So he has been smart on some things.
Right, absolutely. And I think that his whole... saying, hey, you know, the gatekeepers have been removed from, you know, for filmmakers, and you can make your own movie and just get it out there. That's true. If you want to, you know, really struggle and get your movie out there as an unknown, you can make a movie, pay for it yourself, and basically
post it online.
And hawk it yourself. Yes, you can do that, especially to a niche audience. But as far as getting it onto 3,000 screens or even, let's say, 50 screens in theaters around the world and or country, yeah, good luck with that.
I wonder if he listens to iRadio.
iRadio? No, he probably doesn't listen to iRadio for two reasons, okay? And here's one of them. One, it's not out until the fall, and it's only going to be in the U.S., and we're talking about Apple finally announcing, not iRadio, this is the second reason that he doesn't listen to it, it's called iTunes Radio. They decided not to name it iRadio.
So, how annoying.
Yeah, and what's going to be annoying for people outside North America, and probably the United States, is that you can't get it anywhere but the U.S., at least initially.
Okay, I'm sure that obviously they just have to make the deals and then they will expand it around the world. We've talked about it a bit. Is there any news that they related in this that's sort of different from what we expected?
No, in fact, what they should have said when they were announcing this was, hey, we're going to launch iTunes Radio, as you've probably read, in 1,001 tech blogs. So check there for all of the details on it, except the one thing you probably don't know is that it's going to be free with commercials unless you are a member of iTunes Match, in which case it'll be commercial free. That's the one thing that nobody knew about, and it was kind of easy to predict.
What, pray tell, is iTunes Match?
Oh my God, don't get me started. It's this whole thing where you upload the music to the cloud and you can sync all of your devices.
Oh, that thing. Yeah.
The thing is, never really took off, frankly. But it is, I have to admit, it's fantastic. And how could you say what iTunes matches? We had Bob Boylan on last June to talk about.
Well, I've forgotten because it just blurs in your mind all these, you know, iRadio internet stuff. If you don't use it, it sort of falls out of your head. But now that you remind me, I remember what it is. And I certainly remember what Pandora is. What are they up to? Because that's one of the companies iTunes Radio is going to be taking on.
That's right. Pandora is by far one of the, I mean, when you think of internet radio, you think Pandora, right? I mean, they were first.
And Spotify, yeah.
And Spotify. Spotify is more of a listening on demand as opposed to a radio model, although they do have radio type features and functionality. That said, Pandora went out and said, look, our royalties are going to go through the roof. How can we keep our royalties at the level they're at right now, which is the same as radio stations? Well, they went out and purchased a small radio station in South Dakota, in Rapid City, South Dakota, so that they can pay the lower rate to ASCAP as a radio station. It was a hot AC radio station, KXMZ-FM in Rapid City, South Dakota. And so they purchased this thing, and now everybody's up in arms.
So that's cute. They said, we're not an online internet service. We're just the streaming outlet for our radio station in Rapid City, South Dakota.
That's right. Exactly.
That's awesome. I wonder if that station, if the DJs there get to continue doing whatever they do and whether they will stream it onto Pandora. That's kind of, you know, suddenly they're going to become an internationally famous radio station.
They are now, yeah, because, you know, I'm sure, you know, 70,000 people live in the town and in Rapid City. I think 700,000 people live in South Dakota in total. And so here they are buying this small radio station and saying, now we are just like Clear Channel's iHeartRadio. We're going to pay the lower performance royalty rates rather than these higher internet-only station rates that you're going to force us to pay shortly.
Someone is headed to court.
I could not agree more. I will not be.
And radio is headed to more countries. Tell us about it.
Is it radio or RDO? This is the streaming music.
I would call it radio. It's RDIO, but how else am I going to say it?
I don't know. I everybody calls it RDO that I know.
Oh, well, then you're right. I'm sure. It's RDO, which is stupid.
Right. Well, you know, think about it. Radio.com was probably too expensive a domain name for them to purchase, so they left out the A. They misspelled the name of their company to get a better domain name. But that said, it is a kind of Pandora-like, Spotify-like service here in the U.S., and it is now launching in Malaysia, Hong Kong, Colombia, Chile, the Czech Republic, Switzerland, and Poland. They're getting a little bit more geographically diverse, I suppose, is the word you can use.
All I can say is, what's wrong with Slovakia?
Slovakia? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they didn't get the rights or the licenses for Slovakia. I don't know.
It just seems unfair. There you are, right across the border, and everybody in the Czech Republic, Václav Havel, is listening to his music on RDO, and you're 1-2 feet away in Slovakia, and you can't listen to a thing. Seems unfair.
Well, you know, what can I say?
And the Tony Awards were unfair. I was a little depressed. Most of my shows did not win big, except for Vanya and Sonya and Masha and Spike, which won Best New Play. I was happy about that. And now we're getting the fallout from the Tony Awards. We're seeing which shows have been able to capitalize on their wins and their performance at the broadcast.
That's right. I mean, and Steve Zajcik wrote in the LA Times that effectively, you know, these shows that win Tonys are often, they get these bumps that the Oscar provides a slight bump. Emmys don't really do anything. And the Grammys provide a little bump too, right?
I disagree with all of what you said. I mean, it depends on the film and the project and the time that it happens. But you look at the Emmys, they saved Hill Street Blues. They brought Cagney and Lacey back from the dead. If they'd given more Emmys to Boss on Stars, that Kelsey Grammer drama would still be on the air. So I think the Emmys can have a profound effect when they rally around a new show and give it attention. I think the Tonys, when they give their stamp of approval, don't remember there's a big world outside of Broadway. When Spring Awakening gets that Tony stamp of approval, and something like Once, which are perhaps more fragile shows that you have to convince audiences, yes, this is something to embrace. When they get that big win, it can help that show reach a broader audience. And of course, there's touring. There's a lot to be said for getting the Tony stamp of approval. You can say Tony winning best musical when you tour the country. That helps a lot. So I think it does matter.
Well, he is agreeing with you. Steve Zajcik of the LA Times is absolutely agreeing with you in regards to the Tonys, saying they are absolutely necessary for touring especially, and they do provide those bumps. The Emmys, you just gave me two examples, and we shouldn't get into the Emmys, but you gave me two examples from the 1980s. So
no, I gave you the example of Boss on Stars, which would probably still be on the air if the Emmys had rallied around it. There's plenty of examples. We can go through the whole era. Grammys, same thing. You could turn a new act into a superstar overnight. But like you say, often they're reflecting the big success the project has already had. Your new show on Broadway, your blockbuster success, you've got a really good chance of winning the best Tony. So would The Lion King be off the air if it had not won Tony for Best Musical? Of course not. But, you know, it's off reflecting the excitement. be off the boards. It yeah. reflects the excitement of the shows that are on the boards right now. So, yes, it's sort of a almost unnecessary gesture once you're already a big hit. Well, you know, when you're talking about Matilda and Kinky Boots, there's a real battle back and forth there to see who's going to survive and still be there a year from now. And it's still not clear to me.
Well, Matilda is doing quite well. They have surpassed $21 million in advance ticket sales for all of their future performances. And meanwhile, you got Kinky Boots over there winning Best Musical at the Tonys. And they, on Monday, they took in $1.25 million by selling, I guess they've sold $10 million in advance tickets.
Right. So what happens is the day after the Tonys, there's usually a big bump at the box office. People say, I won a Tonys, or they saw a performance and they really liked it. And they head out to the box office and they buy tickets. And the big winner this week was Kinky Boots, which was already doing very well. And it also got a nice boost at that daily box office. Pippin also did really well. It's been in the $1 million club before, but that full week of the Tonys, it went into the $1 million club. And it had a big boost at the box office on that Monday afterwards. So it's hard to tell. Now, when you talk about advanced ticket sales, some of that's a little shady, a little shadowy. A big show like Matilda came from overseas, and the advanced ticket sales are often paper commitments by big group sales, people who are going to bring in big groups or brokers who are going to commit to a lot of tickets that are going to bring in, you know, tourists and package deals and things like that. And that stuff can sort of evaporate. I mean, you got $21 million, you're doing great. But that was for a musical that was coming to New York with all the attention in the world. And that can sort of, you know, they can come to an agreement and have some of that disappear if, hey, it didn't win the Tony for Best Musical. People find it a little cold. So, you know, it's not written in stone. It's certainly great to have $21 million, and it's twice as good as Kinky Boots. But Kinky Boots is sort of more of an out-of-nowhere hit, whereas Matilda was coming in as a blockbuster based on a known children's book. So that had everything going for it. It's doing strongly. I still believe in it, and that'll be playing down the road. I think Kinky Boots is far less appealing. But we'll have to see where a year from now. Like, Priscilla didn't last a year. And I think Kinky Boots, clearly with this stamp of approval, it's doing better. Last week, it made $1.4 million at the box office. Matilda made $1.1 million. But you know what? They were both sold out.
Well,
they're both sold out.
I think a year from now, I think some 800-pound gorilla of a show is going to come and just stomp all over these guys. That's just my gut.
You're talking about King Kong. It's not called King Kong the Musical, but it could be. It opened in Melbourne, Australia this week, and it got not very good reviews.
Well, talk about off-Broadway, but
I saw a preview on it online, which we talked about, where they performed like three songs and gave people a glimpse of the beast, you know, the Kong. And the songs were weak. And now the show is opened, it's been reviewed, and basically everyone says, hey, they really did a great job with Kong. It's this big technological wonder. They brought to life Kong, the eighth wonder of the world. It's on stage. Pity about the book and the songs.
Yeah. They're like, hey, we all agree with Michael. The songs aren't very good.
Yeah. And the book's not very good. It's by Craig Lucas. He's a big name in Broadway. But they have not pulled it together. It's got a $30 million budget. That's what we think. Of course, they want to bring it to Broadway. No question about that. They have no official plans, but they love to go right where Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is located. That just celebrated its second year on Broadway since it premiered officially opening. It was open, you know, in previews for 7 months before that, because it opened actually in 2010 in previews, but it was 7 months of previews before it opened in June of 2011, the longest preview in history. And now it's been on the boards for 2 years. It made last week a modest $1.2 million. So we think it made some money last week. That was a big week where every show did well because there was a lot of attention from the Tony Awards. So it's been hovering around $1 million. If it goes below that, then we know it's starting to lose money every week. But they say, we have no intention of going anywhere. We're here. We're happy. We love it. So we'll have to see what happens down the road.
Well, now let me ask you this. If King Kong actually makes it, King Kong the Musical or whatever it's called, if it makes it to Broadway, I'm assuming that this would kind of be like this would be big news.
Well, technically, yes, because it's a big budget. It sounds like a big whoop, but this show's not very good.
Ooh, okay. Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and we tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. 20th Century Fox is launching what it hopes will be a major new franchise based on the kids' book series, Choose Your Own Adventures. Talk about the 80s. They were wildly popular in the 1980s and into the 1990s. The books, or as they were referred to, game books, you know, they were dubbed game books, sold some 250 million copies with their tales of heroes faced with choices. The readers picked one of several options, and that led the story into a new direction until the tale climaxed, interesting use of words there, with one of dozens of possible conclusions. They were placed in every genre and setting and time frame possible, from sci-fi to westerns to detective tales, so the possibilities really are endless. Maybe, a post-apocalyptic, anyway. Which adventure will Fox choose? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I would say big whoop.
Okay, well, you know, I'm going to choose my own adventure and go right to the next story then.
Well, no, I would just say, I always hated these books as a kid. I thought they were so stupid. I'm stunned that they sold 250 million copies. I mean, I'm like, I want to read a good book. If I want to choose, like, it just was moronic. It's like, well, what do you mean I choose? You mean there's no real story? I hated them as a kid. But the concept, the entire point of the book, the entire appeal was that you get to choose your own adventure and decide what the hero does. How does that translate into a movie?
I have no idea.
It translates into a video game, but it does not translate into a movie. How can you make a movie out of something where the whole point is that you get to decide what happens?
Well, speaking of video games, the video game console wars are heating up at both Sony and Microsoft because they are preparing to launch their new systems. They were announced last week, and of course, we talked about the Xbox last week. Sony made a lot of hay, touting how user-friendly its consoles were. You don't need to connect to the internet regularly, i.e., every 24 hours, just to use their console, for example, and it's $100 cheaper, so what's not to like? They make a point of saying, if you buy a copy of a game for the PS4, then you own that copy forever. But they capped it with an instructional video on how to share your video games with others. It begins with dramatic music and then shows one guy handing the cartridge to another guy, who smiles and says, thanks. That's it. Big deal or big whoop.
And the video is hilarious. It's such an FU to Microsoft. It's like, da da da, here's how you do it. Da 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 da. Here you go. Thanks. So I think it's a big deal. I think if they can actually make this a marketing point and they can gain an advantage on Microsoft by A, following the law, because you're not allowed to stop people from selling stuff that they've purchased legally. If you actually follow the law, but you make a big deal about it and say, look how friendly our site is, and realize there's value in making a positive experience for consumers, that would be a great thing. I hope if people can choose to support one over the other, that they do support the friendlier terms of Sony and make that a selling point so that Microsoft will change its ways.
Well, I'm going to call it a big whoop, and here's why. Because because Sony has the same exact terms as Microsoft. And that is, except they're $100 cheaper and you don't have to connect to the internet. Those are the two things where they're different. Basically, what
Microsoft is going to let other people block your sale.
So will Sony. Sony is saying, it's not up to us. It's up to the video game publisher.
They're going to have the code in the thing. Then why did they make a video mocking them and showing how
they approached it from a different way? They basically led with, you don't have to connect to the internet, and that we're $100 cheaper. And they backed into it instead of leading with, oh, by the way, you have to connect to the internet.
But their video mocking Microsoft, showing about how you can just give away your thing. Someone can go onto their computer and use it. Someone can do whatever they want. They can sell it at any store they want. You're saying that's not true. They're lying.
It's not that they're lying. It's that
they're lying. Well, they're lying if you're telling me that EA can then step around and say you have to sell it to only this store, otherwise it won't work. Then that's a complete lie, and their video mocking Microsoft is a lie.
Then
is that
yes.
What you're telling me?
Yes, it is. That is exactly
correct. You're kidding
me.
You're kidding me. They made a big deal of mocking Microsoft when in fact they're just BSing.
They are BSing. Yes, they're speaking around the truth.
You're kidding me.
I kid you not.
What were they thinking? Then why wasn't the coverage of it? Everybody saying, you liars.
Because
you stupid
people
last
don't understand
liar.
This to begin with. The people that understand this are all the video game geeks. So the media.
Well, that's where I went. That's where the tech, that's where the story came from. It didn't come from, it was at IGN.com. I wasn't reading Daily News. I was reading IGN.com, and they didn't say Sony lies and pretends that they're friendlier when they're not.
Yes, but if you
Because they all blasted Microsoft. And then they all said, look at this. It's hilarious.
If you read /. They say the headline was Sony's PS4 has less stringent DRM than Xbox One. It doesn't say there isn't DRM. It's less stringent.
Well, less stringent is not the same as that. Everybody has some DRM. The point is not that they have no DRM, but they were lying when they said that they didn't have the same restrictions on used sale copies that Microsoft did. That anybody company that wants to block you and force you to sell at their retailer or not at all can do that. You're telling me that's the deal. If EA says, I'm never going to let you resell your used copies, they won't work on any other device, then Sony's going to go along with that.
That is my understanding, that they're basically passing it through to the publisher.
Well, I read everything about it on geek websites, and I didn't get that out of that. So they failed in not making that clear why they weren't ripping into Sony the way they ripped into Microsoft. You'd have to explain to me some other time. Now I'm annoyed. And I don't even have a game player.
I never would have guessed that.
Oh,
but
my God.
Are you as annoyed as the producers and directors of the talk show, the daytime talk show, Katie? Because that show has been facing a lot of shakeups recently as they try to find their way, especially, you know, a new executive producer came on board recently. And Katie Couric's, you know, talker has really been in turmoil ever since Jeff Zucker left for CNN. Jeff Zucker now running CNN. The show is on its third executive producer. And now two more co-executive producers and a key director, they've all left. It certainly doesn't help that Katie herself or the show was beaten in the key 25 to 54 female demographic that it so hopes to earn, and it was beaten by the Steve Harvey Show, a show that you don't think would actually beat it in that demographic.
That was the big success story of the talk shows.
That's Steve Harvey is the big success story. That's right. And they were just renewed through 2016, and that is the Steve Harvey Show was renewed through 2016. So big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, the show's in turmoil. Katie's in trouble. I mean, these things don't usually crash and burn in a week. They usually stay on the air for a year or two, but clearly they're not getting traction. Steve Harvey is the winner. It's doing better in the key important demos. It's on the uprise. Katie is not doing well. They still don't know what they want to be. I don't know why she just doesn't go to CNN. Yeah, I mean, you know, she doesn't need to do the morning show, but you think CNN would love her draw, would love her appeal, give her what she wants and needs without the pressure of syndication. It wouldn't be the same paycheck, but it would be a comfort zone for her, and I think that's where she'll probably end up.
Probably, yes. Now, speaking of ending up places, and your audio, I have to say, just to our listeners, I guess we're having some audio problems with your connection here, Michael, but well,
I blame you.
You know, you're not the only one.
I blame Sony.
Well, we were going to move on here to our story about Arnold Schwarzenegger. He apparently, and by the way, we have to address him as Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't know why I'm doing this in a pseudo-Austrian accent.
We all wish you wouldn't.
Yeah, okay. Well, he's going to return to a leading role. Well, he did return to a leading role in The Last Stand, which didn't exactly set the world on fire or even on spark or, well, let's just say nobody saw it. But Hollywood is eager to see him back in some iconic roles. Get it back, because he always says, I'll be back. See how we did that there? Okay, in any case, I'm murdering this story. Schwarzenegger was at an education summit in Australia when he spoke to bloggers from a website called The Arnold Fans, who, by the way, are all his children. No, just kidding. That's devoted to... Come on. I'm trying to... Anyway.
Too soon.
Too soon? Okay. He confirmed he'll be starring in Terminator 5 and playing not a human, but the honest-to-goodness Terminator. I'm looking for Sarah Connor. It starts shooting in January of 2014, even though they don't have a director or, say, off the top of my head, a finished script. That's Hollywood for you. Schwarzenegger says he's about to get a new draft of the sequel to Twins dubbed Triplets, so you have that to look forward to. Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito will be joined by Eddie Murphy as the third wheel if that happens. Boy, talk about a third wheel. And King Conan, a.k.a. The Legend of Conan, is just a nice idea, but Schwarzenegger says he's on board. He'll do it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Inevitable big whoop, I guess is the way to put it. But what I find fascinating about this story is the fact that Schwarzenegger, this big Hollywood star once upon a time, was at an education summit in Australia. That just shows the strange path he's taken because he was the governor of California. And he's interviewed by a website called The Arnold Fans, which is a website devoted entirely to Arnold. It's just, and that news got around the world because, you know, that's how the web works. It's just a crazy new world we live in where there can be a website devoted to Arnold Schwarzenegger and it can catch him at an education summit in Australia to talk about and break news on Terminator 5. I think it's just a crazy indication of the world we live in.
Yes, you know, I know two people who had some predictions for that world. They're filmmakers, traditionally. But in any case, Kung Fu Panda You know, DreamWorks.
All right.
Yeah, okay. Well, DreamWorks Animation, which, you know, by the way, it's a different company from the DreamWorks Live Action Studio. And it's not called the DreamWorks Live Action Studio. It's DreamWorks Pictures instead. Well, anyway, they have just announced, and that is DreamWorks Animation. If you're still following us, by the way, congratulations, you win. DreamWorks Animation announced that they're moving up the release date of Kung Fu Panda 3 from 2016 to December 2015. That means some changes on the production end as well, meaning the film will probably suck. Now, instead of the entire film being made essentially in China, only one third of the film will be made there, while two thirds will be made in the U.S. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. We talked about this for a while. You know, DreamWorks Animation are taking this franchise, created it in America, created by their people, and they moved the whole production to China to try and gain some access to the China movie box office. Though we know how they can take with one hand and you know, give with another. So, you know, you can try and try, but that doesn't mean you're going to get anywhere. But anyway, they punished the American Animation Division. They fired a bunch of people. They shrunk it down, even though they've had one success after another virtually at DreamWorks Animation. But now, because of a new release schedule, they got to bring back work to the U.S. So that's good to see. I doubt they'll be rehiring anybody soon, but it's nice to see that they're finally getting a little bit more reward for the franchise that they created.
Well, and ironically, I actually had to cut a story that we were going to cover about how China, and maybe we'll cover it next week. China, I'm working on it for Celluloid Junkie, this story. China took The Croods, which is a DreamWorks Animation film, and they just all of a sudden yanked it out of theaters. Now, it had played past when it was allowed to play, which was, you know, in May. It was supposed to end in May, and it was such a huge hit. It made $63 million in China that the authorities, the government was saying, oh, whoa, pull it. Pull it on Thursday. Meanwhile, that very same day or the next day, there's Jeffrey Katzenberg in the country addressing all these people at a business convention saying, we're going to make movies in China for Chinese families and then ship them out to the rest of the world. I mean, the whole thing is ironic, and it just shows all the twists and turns that trying to do business in China as a Hollywood studio can take. But anyway, let's move on. I guess, do we want to cover the UK authors calling for royalties on ebook loans? Do we want to cover that?
Yes.
We do. Okay. In the US, as you know, Michael, a book is sold to a library and the author and publisher make their share. And that's the way it works. After that, the library is free to loan it out. You know, they're free to loan out the book and ultimately sell off used copies when it decides it doesn't need 50 hardcover editions of the new Dan Brown book, you know, the Da Vinci Combination or whatever it's called. You know, they don't need all those books forever. In the UK, it works a little differently. Books are presumably sold to libraries and publishers, and authors get their share. But after that, library loans are tracked. Every time a physical book is borrowed from the library, the government pays out 6 pence, or as I like to call shillings or shekels, directly to the author. It's a significant lifeline for small and mid-list authors, lucky enough to be carried by a library and borrowed out by readers. Apparently, all libraries now in the UK, they only have Harry Potter books. In any case, this royalty rate doesn't apply yet to ebooks. Best-selling author Philip Pullman is the new head of the Society of Authors starting in August, and he's leading the charge to have authors get the same loan royalty rate for ebooks and they get for physical books. Big deal or big whoop? You know what? Can we just move on? This is a big deal.
It is a big deal. I love this. Anytime there's new technology, the big conglomerates say, oh, we can't give you the same royalties. You got to give us a break, people. Come on, artists. We're moving this new CD thing, and we don't think it's going to take off. Or we're trying to launch DVDs, and we're really worried about it. They always tell you that you have to take a lower rate, a lesser rate, a smaller rate. Never, ever do it. It's a lie. Look at this. They're loaning out ebooks, and they're not giving any money to the authors. They opted out completely, which is outrageous. But I find it fascinating how they do this. I wonder how it works. Really, we know a little bit. But I wonder if any other country does this, where if you borrow a book from a library, that there's a fund to pay authors. And does any money go to the publisher? Or does it just go to the author? Is it government pulled money out of a tax fund? Or, you know, where does the money come from? And how do they track every single ebook loan? It's just an interesting system. People have talked about bringing it to the U.S. And I'm like, well, hey, anything to help authors out more. But who's going to pay for it? The libraries don't have any money. They don't have a budget. So it's intriguing to me. And I wish we could learn more about it. I've tried to find out about it online, but it's hard to parse out what exactly is going on. But thank goodness for Philip Pullman, who's, of course, wealthy from his books, that he's trying to look out for mid-list and smaller authors and make sure they don't get shafted just because people are loaning out an ebook rather than a physical book. That should make no difference as far as the royalties.
Well, you know, if you are a country and you're listening to us and you have libraries in your country, please give us a call or email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and let us know how library royalties work in your country. See, I'm addressing an entire entire countries there.
That's very cool.
Yeah. See how that worked? In any case, Jennifer Nelson was making a documentary film about the song Happy Birthday when she discovered, to her astonishment, although not to mine, I mean, she's making a documentary about the subject, she'd know this, that, you know, apparently she was expected to pay money to the copyright holders if the song is performed in her film. Nelson knew the song was based on the tune Good Morning to All, written by two sisters in the late 1800s.
I imagine goes, good morning to all, good morning to all, something like that.
Right. The later lyrics were adapted to the melody, a common practice in folk music, by the way. It then appeared in print in 1912 as Happy Birthday, though earlier versions probably existed. You know, there's no original idea anymore. A version was finally registered for copyright in 1935. Now, Nelson has filed a class action lawsuit insisting the song is in the public domain and what the company must pay back the millions of dollars it has collected over the last 4 years, this publishing company that owns the rights to Happy Birthday. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess. I mean, I don't know what kind of a case she has, but a couple things. One, how did she not know it wasn't in the public domain? If she's making a movie, like, at what point did she discover this? It seems like a pretty essential fact to know about Happy Birthday, that in fact, when if you use it in a movie, you got to pay a royalty. I mean, that's just part of the song's legend in a way. And two, like, our copyright is so messed up. It should be in the public domain, even if it was registered in 1935. It should be out and in the public domain now anyway, but that's how much we've messed up our copyright law. So, be interested to see if they succeed. But Sherlock Holmes, Happy Birthday, things are, 87 years old? It should be in the public domain.
Well, you know, speaking of messing up laws, we're not going to mess up our gene patent laws. We mentioned this in two previous episodes due to Angelina Jolie coming out and saying that she had been diagnosed with having the BRCA1 gene, and so she had a double mastectomy to avoid breast cancer and ovarian cancer. To avoid breast cancer, really. And the Supreme Court ruled last week that naturally occurring DNA cannot be patented, ironically.
Right, that's an important step. Things that occur naturally in nature, it's hard to argue that you can patent them. And that was involving the company that had, in fact, patented an isolated portion of DNA to do the BRCA1 test. And that's why they were able to tell other people, you can't do this test, we're the only ones. However, it's not clear how this will have a real-world impact yet, because they did rule that the company can patent testing and other methods it develops once it's identified and isolated a portion of the DNA. So it may be a patent in practice, if not in, you know, not in theory, since if they isolate the DNA and are the first to patent a test and nobody else can do the test that they have, or, you know, it's just not clear.
Well, there are other ways to isolate the gene. It's knowing that there's a gene to isolate that is the problem. So, and this isn't
right,
a medical show.
But if they can patent the test for BRCA1 and say, you can't have a test for BRCA1 because we have it and we've patented it, is it only their way of approaching
that's
it?
Correct.
Or, you know,
that's right. Yeah. You would say, yeah. I isolate the gene by way of A, B, C. But if company two isolates the gene by way of A, B, Z or D, well, it's not the same.
Right. Well, according to the New York Times, the floodgates are not going to open right away. We'll have to see how it plays out. But it's certainly good news for people who think that nature should not be patented.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know how it's going to affect real world situations, Michael. You just mentioned that. But I can tell you that for me, I had to pull all of my patents for leaves and grass.
You're really in Borscht Belt mode today.
Borscht Belt mode. Yes, that's true. I did mention vaudeville earlier. Speaking of
vaudeville,
exactly. It's a no-brainer, so it's bound to happen someday that the Muppets will head to Broadway. Yes, Disney Theatricals is toying with the idea. Get it? Toying with the idea. See what we did there? I don't think you see. You need me to repeat it?
Keep going.
They're toying with the idea of bringing the Muppets to the big stage, the big white way. You'd think they would have been considering this for, I don't know, years, but it was prompted by Red Hot Theater director Alex Timbers. He's behind the David Byrne musical Here Lies Love, not to mention the Pee Wee Herman revival, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, Peter and the Starcatcher, that big hit, and the upcoming Rocky musical, which I'm sure will be a big hit. Get it? Because it's Rocky. Yeah. In any case, Timbers told Disney he had a great concept for the Muppets on stage, and so everyone worked together to see what it would be like to have the Muppets in a theater. They called it Avenue Q. And
exactly. Didn't they see Avenue Q? Like, what exactly? I wonder what it would be like. Go see that hit show, why don't you? Anyway.
They did a 15-minute test at the New Amsterdam in New York using pre-existing material. Yes, Kermit sang Rainbow Connection. All were pleased, though it's a long way from happening. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I don't know what to say. It's a big deal for the show to come to Broadway eventually. It's a big whoop to think like, oh my God, Alex had this idea. We should put it on stage. I mean, what was his idea? And in fact, the idea that they should do, it's very clear, is the Muppet Show. They should not do a play with a plot about, you know, oh, this, the Muppets are trying to do this or that or the other thing or adapt one of the movies. Put on a variety show. Because yes. One of the great things they did on the show was have celebrity guests. And there was a Broadway show. It wasn't a big hit, but it's called The Play What I Wrote. And it was based on two, you know, iconic British comedians called Morecambe and Wise. And every
show. Wait, you broke up there. Morecambe and Wise?
Morecambe and Wise. They're okay. Big British comedians like Abbott and Costello. And on this show on Broadway, you know, as a tribute to Morecambe and Wise, they did this show. And they would bring on celebrity guests who were part of one or two skits on the show. It was really funny. Ray Fiennes one night and Bette Midler the next night, and people loved doing it. They started coming on. The Muppet Show could have celebrity guests for like 3 weeks or a month, or, you know, a celebrity could say, I want to be on Broadway for 4 weeks, and you book Bette Midler as the guest on The Muppet Show. And then 4 weeks later, you can do some other celebrity guest. They do a song. They have one skit that you can easily work them into, and, you know, you can just put any celeb into it, but you get to have different celebrity all the time. You get to have new songs, new puppets, and every 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, you just keep refreshing the material. You do some temporary stuff. This week you do Pigs in Space. Next week you do, you know, a cooking thing. And so suddenly 6 months down the road, you've got a fairly new show where like half the material is new. We've talked about this with Spider-Man, where they were going to insert new songs and keep changing it up to get people to come back again. The Muppet Show is the perfect chance to do that, where you get people come back every year, but they're not seeing the same show. They get to see half of it's new, or three quarters is new, or a third is new, and it's a different celebrity guest. You could get repeat viewing, and it's not Wicked again for the 10th time. It's actually a fresh, different show. There might be some material you saw before, but there's a lot that would be new. It's like, a great
this
way
is,
to...
This is how Forbidden Broadway has lasted for, you know, eons on...
Exactly. Forbidden Broadway's a great example, and the Muppets are perfect for it. Do the Muppet Show. Do and
well,
make
well, Michael,
it
I
eight,
like it.
Make it 80 minutes and don't have a bloody, you know, don't make it 2.5 hours because they got kids there.
Well,
it would be
awesome. Like it. You are hired. Get rid of
Thank
this Alex Timber guy.
Hack.
Yeah, good grief. Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal. Well, actually, it doesn't, because you know what? We have a semi-related story here that I wanted to literally run past as we run towards Inside Baseball.
You got it.
Jackie Chan. You know Jackie Chan. He's
yes,
interested.
I've interviewed him.
He's interested in Jackie Chan the musical.
That's right. He said, oh, I'm going to do a Jackie Chan musical. And I said, oh, this sounds like a big deal. And I looked into it, and it's a big whoop because nothing's happening.
Okay, well,
he likes the idea. He doesn't have a script, but it's a good idea. And maybe someday we'll do it.
I think Jackie Chan
versus
Rocky.
There's no release date. There's no director. There's no script. There's no idea. There's no cast. There's no anything. It's just he'd like to do it. Okay. Hey, let us know when you get closer.
Here's what I would say. Jackie Chan versus Rocky. Or... Jackie Chan teams up with Rocky to battle King Kong.
And now we move on to Inside Baseball.
Wow, okay, I don't think you liked any of those ideas. Well, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, importantly, you know, more importantly, frankly, is how they affect you. And really, if you're an intern, this story will affect you.
Oh, hold on a second. Timmy, get me my coffee, all right? Milk, no sugar. Don't mess it up this time. Sorry, I was just sending our Showbiz Sandbox intern to go get me new coffee. He made the last one wrong. I threw it into his face.
Well, two things there. One, Timmy is a human being, and you shouldn't be doing that. And two, I hope you ordered it with Sweet and Low. And,
ouch.
I needed a couple of points here. Otherwise, this joke wouldn't have worked. Three, we're now going to have to pay Timmy. Because apparently some judge, like he knows what he's talking about, is saying, hey, you know those interns that worked on Black Swan, Eric Glad and Andrew Footman? Well, they allege that they performed quote-unquote menial tasks, like, I don't know, retrieving lunch for other workers or coffee for other paid workers, and that they should have probably been paid as employees of Fox Searchlight. And apparently Judge Pauly here in, I think it's New York, he said that's true.
That's right. I mean, basically, the studios say, one, these interns don't work for us because every movie is its own business. You know, every time they make a movie, they create a new business shell for it. And they say, well, we're not making the movie. This shell company is making the movie. That's sort of the legalistic fig leaf that they have for it. Two, they say, oh, those are interns. They're getting valuable training and material that will help them in their careers. And in fact, the judge looked at what they do and says, actually, they're just menial labor that you use for free. And they get the credit, but they don't learn anything more than anybody else does if they sit around a movie set and watch. It's not like you design to educate them or introduce them to ideas and train them in ways that they wouldn't get otherwise. Basically, they're just lucky to be on the set. And like any stagehand or crew guy, they're watching and their eyes are open. So they're learning stuff, but it's not really an internship where you're actually trying to train and educate them. So that's a lie. And guess what? When you got free labor, you don't get to do that. That's called slavery, and you got to pay them. And it won't affect just the movie business, but all of, you know, the financial industry, every big industry has cheap labor that, you know, they use as they call interns. You know, it's like that. My first job was as an intern. I worked 20 hours a week for free at Premiere Magazine, and I was happy to get it because I got my foot in the door.
Right. Well, and that's it. I mean, you have to derive an immediate advantage from doing the work of an intern.
And I didn't.
And
I
was cannot displace a regular employee.
Well, I didn't because they never had regular employees do what we did. You know, so it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Well, they didn't displace regular employees because they can depend on interns to do all this grunt work. And it's throughout many industries. So it will have a wide impact.
Right. I mean, effectively, internship means training. That's what the law states. And Judge Pauly came back and said, yeah, no, they weren't getting trained in anything other than how to, you know, how to fetch. And frankly, they didn't need to learn that. That's not what they were there for. You didn't give them any real work to do that would train them in anything specific to an industry. So you know what? They do deserve to be paid.
I wonder if CAA has any interns.
Oh, I believe they did. Well, you know, speaking of CAA, CAA is Creative Artists Agency. They are the largest talent agency in the world, and certainly in Hollywood. And their big rival is William Morris Endeavor, the number two agency right down the street here in Century City and Beverly Hills, of course. And, you know, I don't know if they have interns, but they certainly do have mailroom employees who they send on little errands and to deliver scripts. Oh, maybe not to deliver scripts anymore now that there's email. But they, you know, these mailroom folks eventually kind of grow up and become agents. And it's the way to become an agent is to go through the mailroom. It's kind of notorious. David Geffen got fired out of the mailroom at William Morris many, many moons ago. And so, you know, I guess there's always this rivalry between these two agencies. And this is really insidery. And how will it affect our listeners? It probably won't. But
it doesn't even affect them. We talked about it last week. Right. William Morris Endeavor took a cheap little stab at CAA by running posters, you know, some billboard ads making fun of CAA.
Right.
And now CAA has retaliated.
Right. Well, we don't know whether. I guess they did it retaliate. The William Morris ad was the CAA logo, CAA with the letters N apostrophe T. So can't. That was kind of the joke there. And they placed all of these posters up around the CAA offices in Century City. And
not around their offices, around the city. I mean, well, nearby.
Nearby, yes.
Yeah. And so CAA responded by putting an ad on a bench that said, blow me.
Right.
BLOWME.
Yeah, the WME logo with the BLO written out.
Sounds as childish as I always imagined they were.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah, it's stupid, it's meaningless, and nobody cares.
Well, this is called Showbiz Sandbox, after all.
Yeah, I know, but it's meaningless. It's like, it's nothing of import.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know what is important, though? It's important that you subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher, anywhere they give out podcasts for free. You can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, we urge you to rate and review the show on any of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Showbiz Sandbox. And on Facebook, facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox. You can search for us. Our Facebook page is under Showbiz Sandbox. Links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's show, including Kyle Buchanan's story. And I'd like to thank Kyle Buchanan from New York Magazine once again for joining us to discuss his story about the apocalyptic movies, really, I guess is what you would call them. You know what? All of those links can be found on our webpage at showbizsandbox.com. That's showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their own webpage, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has one of them webpage thingies. It is?
You can find me at borschtbeltanonymous.com.
Borschtbeltanonymous.com. Yes, well, we probably do.
I'm looking into info on how to help you and have a confrontation so that we can, you know, get all your family and friends together and say, Sperling.
A confrontation, you mean an intervention.
An intervention.
Yes.
That's right. Oi, I can't even say the right word.
We have a confrontation every week. So
that's right.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's a conversation. I apologize.
And when I'm not there, I'm at bookfilter.com.
That's right. Or you can find some of his work at michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.